Chapter 34. Miller cracked at 21 minutes. I didn't need the Hendrix to tell me. The datalink terminal that I had jacked into the virtual phone suddenly sputtered to life and started chittering out hard copy. I got up and went over to look what was coming out. The program was supposed to tidy up what Miller was saying so it read sanely, but even after processing, the transcript was pretty incoherent. Miller had let himself slide close to the edge before he'd given in. I scanned the first few lines and saw the beginnings of what I wanted emerging from the gibberish. "Wipe the file, replicants," I told the hotel, crossing rapidly back to the rack. "Give him a couple of hours to calm down, then jack me in.
Connection time will exceed 1 minute, which at current ratio is 3 hours 56 minutes. Do you wish a construct installed until you can be delivered to the format?"
"Yeah, that would be..." I stopped halfway through settling the hypnophones around my head. "Wait a minute. How good's the construct?"
"I am an Emerson series mainframe synthetic intelligence," the hotel said reproachfully. "At maximum fidelity, my virtual constructs are indistinguishable from the projected consciousness they are based on. Subject has now been alone for 1 hour and 27 minutes. Do you wish the construct installed?"
"Yes." The words gave me an eerie feeling even as I was speaking them. "In fact, let it do the whole interrogation."
"Installation complete."
I snapped the phones back again and sat on the edge of the rack, thinking about the implications of a second me inside the Hendrix's vast processing system. It was something that I had never, as far as I knew, been subject to in the core, and I had certainly never trusted any machine enough to do it once I was operating in a criminal context. I cleared my throat. This construct, will it know what it is?
"Initially, no. It will know everything that you knew when you exited from the format, and no more. Though given your intelligence, it will deduce the facts eventually unless otherwise programmed. Do you wish a blocking subprogram installed?"
"No," I said quickly.
"Do you wish me to maintain the format indefinitely?"
"No. Close it down when the construct decides we've got enough." Another thought struck me. "Does the construct carry that virtual locator they wired into me?"
"At present, yes. I am running the same mirror code to mask the signal as I did with your own consciousness. However, since the construct is not directly connected to your cortical stack, I can subtract the signal if you wish."
"Is it worth the trouble?"
"The mirror code is easier to administer," the hotel admitted.
"Leave it, then." There was an uncomfortable bubble sitting in the pit of my stomach at the thought of editing my virtual self. It reflected far too closely on the arbitrary measures that the Kawaharas and Bancrofts took in the real world, with real people. Raw power, unleashed.
"You have a virtual format call," the Hendrix announced.
I looked up, surprised and hopeful. "Ortega?"
"Cadman," the hotel said diffidently. "Will you accept the call?"
The format was a desert. Reddish dust and sandstone underfoot. Sky nailed down from horizon to horizon, cloudless blue. Sun and a pale three-quarter moon hung high and sterile above a distant range of shelf-like mountains. The temperature was a jarring chill, making a mockery of the sun's blinding glare. The patchwork man stood waiting for me. In the empty landscape, he looked like a graven image, a rendering of some savage desert spirit. He grinned when he saw me.
"What do you want, Cadman?" "If you're looking for influence with Kawahara, I'm afraid you're out of luck. She's pissed off with you beyond repair."
A flicker of amusement crossed Cadman's face, and he shook his head slowly as if to dismiss Kawahara from the proceedings completely. His voice was deep and melodic.
"You and I have unfinished business," he said.
"Yeah, you fucked up twice in a row," I ladled scorn into my voice. "What do you want, a third shot at it?"
Cadman shrugged his massive shoulders.
"Well, third time lucky, they say. Allow me to show you something."
He gestured in the air beside him, and a flap of the desert backdrop peeled away from a blackness beyond. The screen it formed sizzled and sprang to life, close focus on sleeping features. Ortega's. A fist snapped closed around my heart. Her face was gray and bruised-looking under the eyes. A thin thread of drool ran from one corner of her mouth. Stunbolt at close range. The last time I'd caught a full stun charge was courtesy of the Millsport Public Order Police, and although the envoy conditioning had forced me back to a kind of consciousness in about 20 minutes, I hadn't been up to much more than shivering and twitching for the next couple of hours. There was no telling how long Ortega had been hit, but she looked bad. "It's a simple exchange," Cadman said. "You for her. I'm parked around the block on a street called Minna. I'll be there for the next 5 minutes. Come alone, or I blow her stack out the back of her neck. Your choice." The desert fizzled out on the patchwork man, smiling. I made the two corners of the block and Minna in a minute flat. 2 weeks without smoking was like a newly discovered compartment at the bottom of Riker's lungs. It was a sad little street of sealed-up frontages and vacant lots. There was no one around. The only vehicle in sight was a matte gray cruiser waiting at the curb, lights on in the gathering gloom of early evening. I approached hesitantly, hand on the butt of the Nemex. When I was 5 meters from the rear of the cruiser, a door opened, and Ortega's body was pitched out. She hit the street like a sack and stayed down, crumpled. I cleared the Nemex as she hit and circled warily around toward her, eyes fixed on the car. A door cracked open on the far side, and Cadman climbed out. So soon after seeing him in virtual, it took a moment to click. Tall, dark-skinned, the hawk visage I had last seen dreaming and fluid behind the glass of the Panama Rosa's resleeving tank. The right hand of God martyr clone, and hiding beneath its flesh, the patchwork man. I drew a bead on his throat with the Nemex. Across the width of the cruiser and very little more. Whatever else happened afterwards, it would take his head off and probably rip the stack out of his spine.
"Don't be ridiculous, Kovach. This vehicle is armored."
I shook my head. "Only interested in you. Just stay exactly where you are." With the Nemex still extended, my eyes still fixed on the target area above his Adam's apple, I lowered myself into a crouch beside Ortega and reached down to her face with the fingers of my free hand. Warm breath stirred around my fingertips. I felt blindly toward the neck for a pulse and found it, weak but stable.
"The lieutenant is alive and well," Cadman said impatiently, "which is more than we shall be able to say for either of you in 2 minutes' time if you don't put down that cannon and get into the car."
Beneath my hand, Ortega's face moved. Her head rolled, and I caught her scent. Her half of the pheromonal match that had locked us both into this in the first place. Her voice was weak and slurred from the stun charge.
"Don't do this, Kovach. You don't owe me."
I stood up and lowered the Nemex slightly. "Back off. 50 meters up the street. She can't walk, and you could cut us both down before I can carry her 2 meters. You back off. I walk to the car." I wagged the gun. "Ortega keeps the hardware. It's all I'm carrying." I lifted my jacket to demonstrate. Cadman nodded. He ducked back inside the cruiser, and the vehicle rolled smoothly down the block. I watched it until it stopped, then knelt beside Ortega again. She struggled to sit up.
"Kovach, don't. They're going to kill you."
"Yes, they're certainly going to try." I took her hand and folded it around the butt of the Nemex. "Listen, I'm all finished here in any case. Bancroft sold. Kawahara will keep her word and freight Sarah back. I know her. What you've got to do is bust her for Mary Lou Hinchley and get Riker off stack. Talk to the Hendricks. I left you a few loose ends there." From down the street, the cruiser sounded its collision alert impatiently. In the gathering gloom of the street, it sounded mournful and ancient, like the hoot of a dying elephant ray on Harada's reef. Ortega looked up out of her stun-blasted face as if she was drowning there.
You...
I smiled and rested a hand against her cheek. Got to get to the next screen, Kristen. That's all. Then I stood up, locked my hands together on the nape of my neck, and walked toward the car. Part 5. Nemesis. Systems Crash. Chapter 35. In the cruiser, I was sandwiched between two impressive muscle men who, with a bit of cosmetic surgery to mess up their clone good looks, could have hired out as freak fighters on bulk alone. We climbed sedately away from the street and banked around. I tipped a glance out of the side window and saw Ortega below, trying to prop herself upright.
"I creamed the Shia cunt?"
the driver wanted to know. I tensed myself for a forward leap. "No." Cadman turned in his seat to look at me. "No, I gave Mr. Kovach my word. I believe the lieutenant and I will cross paths again in the not-too-distant future." "Too bad for you," I told him unconvincingly. And then they shot me with a stunner. When I woke up, there was a face watching me from close up. The features were vague, pale, and blurred, like some kind of theatrical mask. I blinked, shivered, and hauled in focus. The face drew back, still doll-like in its lack of resolution. I coughed. "Hello, carnage." The crude features sketched a smile.
"Welcome back to the Panama Rose, Mr. Kovach."
I sat up shakily on a narrow metal bunk. Carnage stepped back to give me space, or just to stay out of grabbing range. Smeared vision gave me a cramped cabin and gray steel behind him. I swung my feet to the floor and stopped abruptly. The nerves in my arms and legs were still jangling from the stun bolt, and there was a sick, trembling feeling in the pit of my stomach. All things considered, it felt like the results of a very dilute beam, or maybe a series. I glanced down at myself and saw that I was dressed in a heavy canvas gi the color of quarried granite. On the floor beside the bunk were a pair of matching space deck slippers and a belt. I began to get an unpleasant inkling of what Cadman had planned. Behind Carnage, the door of the cabin opened. A tall blonde woman, apparently in her early 40s, stepped in, followed by another synthetic. This one smoothly modern-looking, apart from a gleaming steel direct interface tool in place of a left hand. Carnage busied himself with introductions.
"Mr. Kovach, may I present Pernilla Grip of Combat Broadcast Distributors, and her technical assistant, Miles Mech. Pernilla, Miles, I'd like to present Takashi Kovach, our surrogate Riker for tonight. Congratulations, by the way, Kovach. At the time I was utterly convinced, despite the unlikelihood of Riker making it off stack for the next 200 years, all part of the envoy technique, I understand."
"Not really. Ortega was the convincing factor. All I did was let you talk. You're good at that." I nodded at Carnage's companions. "Did I hear the word broadcast? I thought that went against the creed. Didn't you perform radical surgery on a journalist for that particular crime?"
"Different products, Mr. Kovach, different products. To broadcast a scheduled fight would indeed be a breach of our creed. But this is not a scheduled fight. This is a humiliation bout."
Carnage's surface charm froze over on the phrase.
"With a different and necessarily very limited live audience, we are forced to make up for the loss in revenue somehow. There are a great many networks who are anxious to get their hands on anything that comes out of the Panama Rose. This is the effect our reputation has, but unfortunately it is that same reputation that precludes us doing any such business directly. Ms. Grip handles this market dilemma for us."
"Nice of her." My own voice grew cold. "Where's Cadman?"
"In due time, Mr. Kovach, in due time. You know, when I was told you would react this way and give yourself up for the lieutenant, I confess I doubted it at the time. But you fulfill expectations like a machine. What was it that the Envoy Corps took away from you in return for all your other powers? Your unpredictability? Your soul?
Don't get poetic on me, Carnage. Where is he?
Oh, very well. This way.
There were a brace of large sentries outside the cabin door that might have been the two from the cruiser. I was too jangled to remember clearly. They bracketed me as we followed Carnage along claustrophobic corridors and down listing companionways, all rust-spotted and polymer-varnished metal. I tried vaguely to memorize the path, but most of me was thinking about what Carnage had said. Who had predicted my actions to him? Cadman? Unlikely. The patchwork man, for all his fury and death threats, knew next to nothing about me. The only real candidate for that kind of prediction was Raylene Kawahara, which also helped to explain why Carnage wasn't quaking in his synthetic flesh at the thought of what Kawahara might do to him for cooperating with Cadman. Kawahara had sold me out. Bancroft was convinced. The crisis, whatever it had been, was over, and the same day Ortega was snatched as bait. The scenario I had sold to Bancroft left Cadman out there as a private contractor with a grudge, so there was no reason why he couldn't be seen to take me down. And under the circumstances, I was safer disposed of than left alive. For that matter, so was Cadman. So maybe it hadn't been that blatant. Maybe the word had gone out to bring Cadman down, but only for as long as I was needed. With Bancroft convinced, I was once more expendable, and the word had gone out again to let Cadman be. He could kill me, or I could kill him, whichever way the luck turned, leaving Kawahara to clean up whoever was left. I had no doubt that Kawahara would keep her word as far as releasing Sarah was concerned. The old-style Yakuza were funny about that sort of thing. But she had made no such binding promises about me. We clambered down a final staircase, a little wider than the rest, and came out onto a glassed-in gantry over a converted cargo cell. Looking down, I saw one of the arenas Ortega and I had passed in the Electromag train last week. But now the plastic coverings were off the killing ring, and a modest crowd had assembled in the forward rows of each bank of plastic seating. Through the glass, I could hear the sustained buzz of excitement and anticipation that had always preceded the freak fights I'd attended in my youth.
"Ah, your public awaits you."
Carnage was standing at my shoulder.
"Well, more correctly, Riker's public. Though I have no doubt you'll be able to dissemble for them with the same skill that you convinced me."
"And if I choose not to?" Carnage's crude features formed a simulacrum of distaste. He gestured out at the crowd.
"Well, I suppose you could try explaining it to them in mid-bout. But, to be honest, the acoustics aren't of the best, and anyway..." He smiled unpleasantly. "I doubt you'll have the time."
"Foregone conclusion, huh?" Carnage maintained his smile. Behind him, Pernilla Grip and the other synthetic were watching me with a predatory interest of cats in front of a birdcage. Below, the crowd was becoming noisy with expectation.
"It has taken me a while to set up this particular bout, working on nothing more than Cadman's assurances. They are anxious to see Elias Riker pay for his transgressions, and it would be quite hazardous not to fulfill their expectations, not to mention unprofessional. But then, I do not think you came here expecting to survive, did you, Mr. Kovach?"
I remembered the darkening, deserted street called Minna, and the crumpled form of Ortega. I fought the stun-blast sickness and raised a smile from old stock. "No, I suppose I didn't." Quiet footsteps along the gantry. I fired a peripheral glance toward the sound and found Cadman, attired in the same clothing as I wore. The space deck slippers scuffed to a soft halt a short distance away, and he cocked his head at an angle, as if examining me for the first time. He spoke gently.
"How shall I explain the dying that was done? Shall I say that each one did the math and wrote, the value of his days against the bloody margin in an understated hand. They will want to know, how was the audit done? And I shall say that it was done, for once, by those who knew the worth of what was spent that day. I smiled grimly. If you want to lose a fight, talk about it first. But she was younger in those days. Cadman smiled back, perfect white teeth against the tan skin. Barely out of her teens if the introduction to my copy of Furies got it right. Harlan's world teens last longer. I think she knew what she was talking about. Can we get on with this, please? Beyond the windows, the noise of the crowd was rising like surf on a hard shingle beach.
Chapter 36. Out on the killing floor, the noise was less uniform, more uneven. Individual voices sawed across the background like bottleback fins in choppy water, though without applying the Neurochem, I still couldn't pick out anything intelligible.
Only one shout made it through the general roar. As I stepped up to the edge of the ring, someone yelled down at me.
"Remember my brother, you motherfucker!"
I glanced up to see who the family grudge belonged to, but saw only a sea of angry and anticipatory faces. Several of them were on their feet, waving fists and stamping so that the metal scaffolding drummed with it. The bloodlust was building like something tangible, leaving a thickness in the air that was unpleasant to breathe. I tried to remember whether I and my gang peers had screamed like this at the New Pest freak fights, and guessed that we probably had. And we hadn't even known the combatants who flailed and clawed at each other for our entertainment. These people at least had some emotional investment in the blood they wanted to see spilled. On the other side of the floor, Cadman waited with his arms folded. The supple steel of the power knuckles banded across the fingers of each hand glinted in the overhead lighting. It was a subtle advantage, one which wouldn't render the fight too one-sided, but would tell in the long run. I wasn't really worried about the knuckles. It was Cadman's will of God-enhanced response wiring that concerned me most. A century and a half ago, I'd been up against the same system and the soldiers the Protectorate had been fighting on Sharya, and they'd been no pushover. It was old stuff, but it was heavy-duty military biomech, and against that, Riker's Neurochem, recently fried by Stunbolt, was going to look pretty sick. I took my place opposite Cadman, as indicated by the markings on the floor. Around me the crowd quieted down a little and the spotlights came up as MC Carnage joined us. Robed and made up for Pernilla Grip's cameras, he looked like a malignant doll out of a child's nightmare. A fitting consort to the Patchwork Man. He raised his hands, and directional speakers in the walls of the converted cargo cell amplified his throat-miked words.
"Welcome to the Panama Rose!"
There was a vague rumble from the crowd, but they were bedded down for the moment, waiting. Carnage knew this, and he turned slowly about, milking the anticipation.
"To a very special and very exclusive Panama Rose event, welcome, welcome, I bid you welcome, to the most final and bloody humiliation of Elias Riker!"
They went wild. I raised my eyes to their faces in the gloom and saw the thin skin of civilization stripped away, the rage laid out like raw flesh beneath. Carnage's amplified voice trod down the noise. He was making quieting noises with both arms.
"Most of you will remember Detective Riker from some encounter or other. For some of you it will be a name that you associate with blood spilled, maybe even bones broken. Those memories are painful, and some of you might think you can never lose them."
He had them damped down now, and his voice dropped accordingly.
"My friends, I cannot hope to erase those memories for you, for that is not what we offer aboard the Panama Rose. Here we deal not in soft forgetfulness, but in remembrance, no matter how bitter that remembrance might be. Not in dreams, my friends, but in reality.
He threw out a hand to indicate me.
My friends, this is reality.
Another round of whoops. I glanced across at Cadman and raised my eyebrows in exasperation. I thought I might die, but I hadn't expected to be bored to death. Cadman shrugged. He wanted the fight. Carnage's theatricals were just the slightly distasteful price he had to pay for it.
This is reality,
MC Carnage repeated.
Tonight is reality. Tonight you will watch Elias Riker die. Die on his knees. And if I cannot erase the memories of your bodies being beaten and your bones being broken, I can at least replace them with the sounds of your tormentor being broken instead.
The crowd erupted. I wondered briefly if Carnage was exaggerating. The truth about Riker was an elusive thing, it seemed. I remembered leaving Jerry's closed quarters, the way Octai had flinched away from me when he saw Riker's face. Jerry himself telling me about the Mongols' run-in with a cop whose body I was wearing. Riker used to shake him down all the time. Beat him half to death a couple of years back. And then there was Batista on Riker's interrogation techniques. He's right on the line most of the time. How many times had Riker gone over that line to have attracted this crowd? What would Ortega have said? I thought about Ortega, and the image of her face was a tiny pocket of calm amidst the jeering and yelling that Carnage had whipped up. With luck and what I'd left her at the Hendrix, she'd take Kawahara down for me. Knowing it was enough. Carnage drew a heavy-bladed, serrated knife from his robes and held it aloft. A relative quiet descended on the chamber.
"The coup de grace," he proclaimed. "When our matador has put Elias Riker down so that he no longer has the strength to rise, you will see the stack cut from his living spine and smashed, and you will know that he is no more."
He released the knife and let his arm fall again. Pure theater. The weapon hung in the air, glinting in a focal grav field, then drifted upward to a height of about 5 meters at the midpoint of the killing floor.
"Let us begin," Carnage said, withdrawing.
There was a magical moment then, a kind of release, almost as if an Xperia scene had just been shot. And we could all stand down now and relax, maybe pass around a whiskey flask and clown about behind the scanners. Joke about the cliché-ridden script we were being forced to play out. We began to circle, still the width of the killing floor apart, and no guard up to even hint at what we were about to do. I tried to read Cadman's body language for clues. The Will of God biomech systems 3.1 through 7 are simple, but not to be scorned on that account, they had told us prior to the Sharia landings. The imperatives for the builders were strength and speed, and in both of these they have excelled. If they have a weakness, it is that their combat patterning is no random select subroutine. Right Hand of God martyrs will therefore tend to fight and go on fighting within a very narrow band of techniques. On Sharia, our own enhanced combat systems have been state-of-the-art, with both random response and analysis feedback built in as standard. Riker's Neurochem had nothing approaching that level of sophistication, but I might be able to stimulate it with a few envoy tricks. The real trick was to stay alive long enough for my conditioning to analyze the Will of God's fighting pattern, and Cadman struck. The distance was nearly 10 meters of clear ground. He covered it in the time it took me to blink, and hit me like a storm. The techniques were all simple, linear punches and kicks, but delivered with such power and speed that it was all I could do to block them. Counterattack was out of the question. I steered the first punch outward right and used the momentum to sidestep left. Cadman followed the shift without hesitation and went for my face. I rolled my head away from the strike and felt the fist graze my temple, not hard enough to trigger the power knuckles. Instinct told me to block low, and the knee-shattering straight kick turned off my forearm. A follow-up elbow strike caught me on top of the head,
and I reeled backwards, fighting to stay on my feet. Cadman came after me. I snapped out a right-hand side strike, but he had the attack momentum, and he rode the blow almost casually. A low-level punch snaked through and hit me in the belly. The power knuckles detonated with a sound like meat tossed into a frying pan. It was like someone sinking a grappling iron into my guts. The actual pain of the punch was left far behind on the surface of my skin, and a sickening numbness raged through the muscles in my stomach. On top of the sickness from the stunner, it was crippling. I staggered back 3 steps and crashed onto the mat, twisting like a half-crushed insect. Vaguely, I heard the crowd roaring its approval. Turning my head weakly, I saw Cadman had backed off and was facing me with hooded eyes and both fists raised in front of his face. A faint red light winked at me from the steel band on his left hand. The knuckles. Recharging. I understood. Round 1. Empty-handed combat has only 2 rules. Get in as many blows, as hard and as fast as you can, and put your opponent down. When he's on the ground, you kill him. If there are other rules or considerations, it isn't a real fight. It's a game. Cadman could have come in and finished me when I was down, but this wasn't a real fight. This was a humiliation bout, a game where the suffering was to be maximized for the benefit of the audience. The crowd. I got up and looked around the dimly seen arena of faces. The Nurikim caught on saliva-polished teeth and the yelling mouths. I forced down the weakness in my guts, spat on the killing floor, and summoned a guard stance. Cadman inclined his head, as if acknowledging something, and came at me again. The same flurry of linear techniques, the same speed and power, but this time I was ready for them. I deflected the first 2 punches on a pair of wing blocks, and instead of giving ground, I stayed squarely in Cadman's path. It took him the shreds of a second to realize what I was doing, and by then he was too close. We were almost chest to chest. I let go of the headbutt as if his face belonged to every member of the chanting crowd. The hawk nose broke with a solid crunch, and as he wavered, I took him down with an instep stamp to the knee. The edge of my right hand scythed around, looking for neck or throat, but Cadman had gone all the way down. He rolled and hooked my feet out from under me. As I fell, he rose to his knees beside me and rabbit-punched me in the back. The charge convulsed me and cracked my head against the mat. I tasted blood. I rolled upright and saw Cadman backing off and wiping some blood of his own from his broken nose. He looked curiously at his red-streaked palm and then across at me, then shook his head in disbelief. I grinned weakly, riding the adrenaline surge that seeing his blood spilled had given me, and raised both my own hands in an expectant gesture. "Come on, you asshole," it croaked out of my damaged mouth. "Put me away." He was on me almost before the last word left my mouth. This time I hardly touched him. Most of it happened beyond conscious combat. The Nurikim weathered the battering valiantly, throwing out blocks to keep the knuckles off me, and gave me the space for a couple of randomly generated counter-strikes that Envoy Instinct told me might get through Cadman's fighting pattern. He rode the blows like the attentions of an irritating insect. On the last of these futile riposts, I overreached the punch, and he snagged my wrist, yanking me forward. A perfectly balanced roundhouse kick slammed into my ribs, and I felt them snap. Cadman pulled again, locked out the elbow of my captured arm, and in the frozen frames of Nurikim's speeded vision, I saw the forearm strike swinging down toward the joint. I knew the sound it was going to make when the elbow exploded, knew the sound I was going to make before the Nurikim could lock the pain down. My hand twisted desperately in Cadman's grip, and I let myself fall. Slippery with sweat, my wrist pulled free and my arm unlocked. Cadman hit with bruising force, but the arm held, and by then I was on my way to the floor anyway. I came down on the injured ribs, and my vision flew apart in splinters. I twisted, trying to fight the urge to roll into a fetal ball, and saw Cadman's borrowed features 1,000 meters above me. "Get up," he said,
like vast sheets of cardboard being torn in the distance. "We're not finished yet."
I snapped up from the waist, striking for his groin. The blow was out, spending itself in the meat of his thigh. Almost casually, he swung his arm, and the power knuckles hit me in the face. I saw a scribble of multicolored lights, and then everything whited out. The noise of the crowd ballooned in my head, and behind it I thought I could hear the maelstrom calling me. It all cycled in and out of focus, dip and whirl like a graph drop, while the Neurochem fought to keep me conscious. The lights swooped down and then back to the ceiling, as if concerned to see the damage that had been done to me, but only superficially and easily satisfied. Consciousness was something in wide elliptical orbit around my head. Abruptly, I was back on Sharya, holed up in the wreck of the disabled spider tank with Jimmy DeSoto.
"Earth?"
His grinning blackout-striped face is flash-lit by laser fire from outside the tank.
"It's a shithole, man. Fucking frozen society, like stepping back in time half a millennium. Nothing happens there. Historical events aren't allowed."
"Bullshit." My disbelief is punctuated by the shrill scream of an incoming marauder bomb. Our eyes meet across the gloom of the tank cabin. The bombardment has been going on since nightfall, the robot weapons hunting on infrared and motion track. In a rare moment when the Sharyan jamming went down, we've heard that Admiral Cursiter's IP fleet is still light seconds out, fighting the Sharyans for orbital dominance. At dawn, if the battle isn't over, the locals will probably put down ground troops to flush us out. The odds are not looking good. At least the beta-thenatine crash is starting to wear off. I can feel my temperature beginning to climb back toward normal. The surrounding air no longer feels like hot soup, and breathing is ceasing to be the major effort it was when our heart rates were down near flatline. The robot bomb detonates, and the legs of the tank rattle against the hull with a near miss. We both glance reflexively at our exposure meters.
"Bullshit, is it?"
Jimmy peers out of the ragged hole we blew in the spider tank's hull.
"Hey, you're not from there." "I am, and I'm telling you, if they gave me the choice of life on Earth or fucking storage, I'd have to give it some thought." "You get the chance to visit. Don't."
I blinked the glitch away. Above me, the killing knife glinted in its grav field like sunlight through trees. Jimmy was fading out, heading past the knife for the roof.
"Told you not to go there, didn't I, pal? Now look at you. Earth."
He spat and disappeared, leaving the echoes of his voice.
"It's a shithole. Gotta get to the next screen."
The crowd noise had settled down to a steady chanting. The anger ran through the fog in my head like a hot wire. I propped myself up on an elbow and focused on Cadman, waiting on the other side of the ring. He saw me and raised his hands in an echo of the gesture I had used before. The crowd howled with laughter. "Get to the next screen." I lurched to my feet. "If you don't do your chores, the patchwork man will come for you one night." The voice jumped into my head, a voice I hadn't heard in nearly a century and a half of objective time. A man I hadn't soiled my memory with for most of my adult life. My father and his delightful bedtime stories. Trust him to turn up now, when I really needed the shit. "The patchwork man will come for you." "Well, you got that wrong, Dad. The patchwork man's standing right over there waiting. He's not coming for me. Have to go and get him myself. But thanks anyway, Dad. Thanks for everything." I summoned what was left from cellular levels in Riker's body and stalked forward. Glass shattered high above the killing floor. The shards rained down on the space between Cadman and myself.
"Cadman!"
I saw his eyes rise to the gantry above, and then his entire chest seemed to explode. His head and arms jerked back as if something had suddenly thrown him wildly off balance, and a detonation rang through the chamber. The front of his gi was torn off, and a magical hole opened him up from throat to waist. Blood gouted and fell in ropes. I whipped around, staring upward,
and saw Trep framed in the gantry window she had just destroyed, eyes still bent along the barrel of the frag rifle cradled in her arms. The muzzle flamed as she laid down continuous fire. Confused, I swung about, looking for targets, but the killing floor was deserted but for the remains of Cadman. Carnage was nowhere in sight, and between explosions the noise of the crowd had changed abruptly to the hooting sounds of humans in panic. Everyone seemed to be on their feet, trying to leave. Understanding hit. Trep was firing into the audience. Down on the floor of the chamber, an energy weapon cut loose, and someone started screaming. I turned, suddenly slow and awkward, toward the sound. Carnage was on fire. Braced in the chamber door beyond, Rodrigo Bautista stood hosing wide-beam fire from a long-barreled blaster. Carnage was in flames from the waist up, beating at himself with arms that had themselves grown wings of fire. The shrieking he made was more the sound of fury than pain. Pernilla Grip lay dead at his feet, chest scorched through. As I watched, Carnage pitched forward over her like a figure made of melting wax, and his shrieks modulated down through groans to a weird electronic bubbling, and then to nothing.
Kovach!
Trep's frag gun had fallen silent, and against the ensuing background of groaning and cries from the injured, Bautista's raised voice was unnaturally loud. He detoured around the burning synthetic and climbed up into the ring. His face was streaked with blood.
"You okay, Kovach?"
I chuckled weakly, then clutched abruptly at the stabbing pain in my side.
"Great. Just great. How's Ortega?"
"She's okay. Got her dosed up on lethanol for the shock. Sorry we got here so late."
He gestured up at Trep. "Took your friend there a while to get through to me at Fell Street.
She refused to go through official channels. Said it wouldn't scan right. The mess we made coming in here, she ain't far wrong."
I glanced around at the manifest organic damage.
"Yeah, not gonna be a problem?"
Bautista barked a laugh.
"Are you ragging me? Entry without a warrant? Organic damage to unarmed suspects? What the fuck do you think?"
"Sorry about that."
I started to move off the killing floor.
"Maybe we can work something out." "Hey."
Bautista caught my arm.
"They took off a Bay City cop. No one does that around here. Someone should have told Cadman before he made the fucking mistake."
I wasn't sure if he was talking about Ortega or me in my Riker sleeve, so I said nothing. Instead, I tipped my head back gingerly, testing for damage, and looked up at Trep. She was reloading the frag gun.
"Hi. You gonna stay up there all night?"
"Be right down."
She jacked the last shell into the frag gun, then executed a neat somersault over the gantry rail and fell outward. About a meter into the fall, the grav harness on her back spread its wings and she fetched up hanging over us at head height, with the gun slung across her shoulder. In her long black coat, she looked like an off-duty dark angel. Adjusting a dial on the harness, she drifted closer to the floor and finally touched down next to Cadman. I limped up to join her. We both looked at the ripped-open corpse in silence for a moment.
"Thanks," I said softly.
"Forget it. All part of the service. Sorry I had to bring in these guys, but I needed the backup and fast. You know what they say about the Shia around here. Biggest fucking gang on the block, right?"
She nodded at Cadman.
"You're going to leave him like that?"
I stared at the right hand of God Martyr with his face shocked into abrupt death, and tried to see the patchwork man inside him. "No," I said, and turned the corpse over with my foot so that the nape of the neck was exposed.
"Bautista, you want to lend me that firecracker?"
Wordlessly, the cop handed me his blaster. I set the muzzle against the base of the patchwork man's skull, rested it there, and waited to feel something.
"Anyone want to say anything?"
Trep cracked, deadpan. Bautista turned away.
"Just do it."
If my father had any comments, he kept them to himself.
The only voices were the cries of the injured spectators, and those I ignored. Feeling nothing, I pulled the trigger. Chapter 37. I was still feeling nothing an hour later when Ortega came and found me in the sleeping hall, seated on one of the automated forklifts, and staring up into the green glow from the empty decanting chambers. The airlock made a smooth thump, and then a sustained humming sound as it opened, but I didn't react. Even when I recognized her footfalls and a short curse as she picked her way between the coiled cabling on the floor, I didn't look around. Like the machine I was seated on, I was powered down.
"How you feeling?"
I looked down to where she stood beside the forklift. Like I looked, probably.
"Well, you look like shit."
She reached up to where I was seated and grasped a convenient grill cover.
"You mind if I join you?"
"Go ahead. Want a hand up?"
"Nope."
Ortega strained to lift herself by her arms, turned gray with the effort, and hung there with a lopsided grin.
"Possibly."
I lent her the least bruised of my arms, and she came aboard the forklift with a grunt. She squatted awkwardly for a moment, then seated herself next to me and rubbed at her shoulders.
"Christ, it's cold in here. How long have you been sitting on this thing?"
"About an hour." She looked up at the empty tanks.
"Seen anything interesting?"
"I'm thinking."
"Oh."
She paused again.
"You know, this fucking lethanol is worse than a stun gun. At least when you've been stunned, you know you're damaged. Lethanol tells you that whatever you've been through, everything's just fine, and just go ahead and relax. And then you fall ass over tit on the first 5-centimeter cable you try to step over."
"I think you're supposed to be lying down," I said mildly.
"Yeah, well, probably so are you. You're going to have some nice facial bruises by tomorrow. Mercer give you a shot for the pain?"
"Didn't need it."
"Oh, hard man. I thought we agreed you were going to look after that sleeve."
I smiled reflexively. "You should see the other guy."
"I did see the other guy. Ripped him apart with your bare hands, huh?"
I kept the smile. "Where's Trep?"
"Your wirehead friend? She's gone. Said something to Bautista about a conflict of interest and disappeared into the night. Bautista's tearing his hair out trying to think of a way to cover this mess. Want to come and talk to him?"
"All right." I shifted unwillingly. There was something hypnotic about the green light from the decanting tanks, and beneath my numbness, ideas were beginning to circle restlessly, snapping at each other like bottle backs in a feeding spiral. The death of Cadman, far from relieving me, had only touched off a slow-burning fuse of destructive urges in the pit of my stomach. Someone was going to pay for all this. Personal. But this was worse than personal. This was about Louise, alias an enemy, cut up on a surgical platter. About Elizabeth Elliot, stabbed to death and too poor to be re-sleeved. Irene Elliot, weeping for a body that a corporate rep wore on alternate months. Victor Elliot, whiplashed between loss and retrieval of someone who was, and yet was not, the same woman. This was about a young black man facing his family in a broken-down, middle-aged white body. It was about Virginia Bedora walking disdainfully into storage with her head held high and a last cigarette polluting lung she was about to lose, no doubt to some other corporate vampire. It was about Jimmy DeSoto clawing his own eye out in the mud and fire at Inanen, and the millions like him throughout the Protectorate, painfully gathered assemblages of individual human potential, pissed away into the dung heap of history. For all these, and more, someone was going to pay. A little dizzily, I climbed down from the forklift and helped Ortega down after me. It hurt my arms to take her weight, but nowhere near as much as the sudden, freezing knowledge that these were our last hours together. I didn't know where the realization came from, but it came with a solid settling sensation in the bedrock of my mind that I had long ago learned to trust more than rational thought. We left the resleeving chamber hand in hand, neither of us really noticing the fact until we came face to face with Bautista in the corridor outside, and pulled instinctively apart again. "Been looking for you, Kovach." If Bautista had any feelings about the hand-holding, nothing showed in his face. "Your mercenary friend skipped and left us to do the cleaning up." "Yeah, Krista..." I stopped and nodded sideways at Ortega. "I've been told. Did she take the frag gun?" Bautista nodded. "So you've got a perfect story. Someone called in gunfire from the Panama Rose. You came out to look and found the audience massacred. Cadman and Carnage dead. Me and Ortega halfway there. Must have been someone Carnage upset, working off a grudge." Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Ortega shake her head. "Ain't gonna scan," Bautista said. "All calls in the Fell Street get recorded. Same goes for the phones and the cruises." I shrugged, feeling the envoy waking within me. "So what? You or Ortega, you've got snitches out here in Richmond. People whose names you can't disclose. Call came in on a personal phone, which just happened to get smashed when you had to shoot your way past the remains of Carnage's security guards. No trace. And nothing on the monitors because the mysterious someone, whoever did all the shooting, wiped the whole automated security system clean. That can be arranged, I take it." Bautista looked dubious. "I suppose we'd need a data rat to do it. Davidson's good with a deck, but he ain't that good." "I can get you a data rat. Anything else?" "Some of the audience is still alive. Not in any fit state to do anything, but they're still breathing." "Forget them. If they saw anything, it was Trep. Probably not even that, clearly. Whole thing was over in a couple of seconds. The only thing we've got to decide is when to call the meat wagons." "Sometime soon," Ortega said, "or it's going to look suspicious." Bautista snorted. "This whole fucking thing looks suspicious. Anyone at Fell Street's gonna know what went down here tonight." "Do this sort of thing a lot, do you?" "That ain't funny, Kovach. Carnage went over the line. He knew what he was calling down."
"Carnage," Ortega muttered. "That motherfucker's got himself stored somewhere. As soon as he gets resleeved, he's going to be screaming for an investigation."
"Maybe not," Bautista said. "How long ago you reckon he was copied into that synth?" Ortega shrugged. "Who knows? He was wearing it last week. At least that long, unless he had the store copy updated, and that's fucking expensive." "If I were someone like Carnage," I said thoughtfully, "I'd get myself updated whenever something major went down, no matter what it cost. I wouldn't want to wake up not knowing what the fuck I'd been doing the week before I got torched." "That depends on what you were doing," Bautista pointed out. "If it was some seriously illegal shit, you might prefer to wake up not knowing about it. That way, you polygraph your way right out of police interrogation with a smile. Better than that, you wouldn't even..." I trailed off, thinking about it. Bautista made an impatient gesture. "Whatever. If Carnage wakes up not knowing, he might make some private inquiries, but he ain't gonna be in too much of a hurry to let the police department in on it. And if he wakes up knowing..." He spread his hands. "He'll make less noise than a Catholic orgasm. I think we're in the clear here."
"Get the ambulances, then, and maybe call Moraro in to..."
But Ortega's voice was fading out as the last part of the puzzle sank snugly into its resting place. The conversation between the two cops grew as remote as star static over a suit comlink. I gazed at a tiny dent on the metal wall beside me, hammering at the idea with every logic test I could muster. Bautista gave me a curious glance, then left to call the ambulances. As he disappeared, Ortega touched me lightly on the arm.
"Hey, Kovach, you okay?"
I blinked.
"Kovach?"
I put out a hand and touched the wall, as if to assure myself of its solidity. Compared to the certainty of a concept I was experiencing, my surroundings seemed suddenly intangible.
"Kristen," I said slowly, "I have to get aboard Head in the Clouds. I know what they did to Bancroft. I can bring Kawahara down and get Resolution 653 pushed through. And I can spring Riker."
Ortega sighed.
Kovach, we've been through...
No!
The savagery in my voice was so abrupt it shocked even me. I could feel the bruising in Riker's face hurt as his features tensed. This isn't speculation. This isn't a cast in the dark. This is a fact. And I am going aboard Head in the Clouds, with or without your help. But I'm going. Kovach, Ortega shook her head. Look at yourself. You're a mess. Right now you couldn't take on an Oakland pimp. And you're talking about covert assault on one of the West Coast houses. You think you're going to crash Kawahara's security with broken ribs and that face? Forget it.
I didn't say it was going to be easy.
Kovach, it isn't going to be. I sat on the Hendrix tapes long enough for you to pull that shit with Bancroft, but that's as far as it goes. The game's over. Your friend Sarah gets to go home, and so do you. But that's it. I'm not interested in grudge matches.
Do you really want Riker back? I asked softly. For a moment, I thought she was going to hit me. Her nostrils flared white, and her right shoulder actually dropped for the punch. I never knew whether it was the stun gun hangover or just self-control that stopped her.
I ought to deck you for that, Kovach, she said evenly.
I raised my hands. Go ahead. Right now I couldn't take on an Oakland pimp, remember? Ortega made a disgusted sound in her throat and started to turn away. I put out my hand and touched her.
Kristen,
I hesitated. I'm sorry. That was a bitchy crack about Riker. Will you at least hear me through once? She came back to me, mouth clamped tight over whatever she was feeling, head down. She swallowed.
I don't... There's been too much...
She cleared her throat.
I don't want you hurt anymore, Kovach. I don't want any more damage, that's all.
Damage to Riker's sleeve, you mean? She looked at me.
No,
she said quietly.
No, I don't mean that. I mean what I say.
Then she was pressed up against me, there in that grim metal corridor, arms wrapped hard around me and face buried in my chest, all without apparent transition. I did some swallowing of my own and held her tightly while the last of what time we had trickled away like grains of sand through my fingers. And at that moment, I would have given almost anything not to have had a plan for her to hear, not to have had any way to dissolve what was growing between us, and not to have hated Raylene Kawahara quite so much. I would have given almost anything. 2 a.m. I called Irene Elliott at the Jack Saul apartment and got her out of bed. I told her we had a problem we'd pay heavily to unkink. She nodded sleepily. Bautista went to get her in an unmarked cruiser. By the time she arrived, the Panama Rose was lit as if for a deck party. Vertical searchlights along her sides made it look as if she was being lowered from the night sky on ropes of luminescence. Aluminum cable incident barriers crisscrossed the superstructure and the dock moorings. The roof of the cargo cell where the humiliation bout had gone down was cranked back to allow the ambulances direct access, and the blast of crime scene lighting from within rose into the night like the glow from a foundry. Police cruisers held the sky and parked across the dock, flashing red and blue. I met her at the gangway.
I want my body back,
she shouted over the whine and roar of airborne engines. The searchlights frosted her sleeves, black hair almost back to blonde.
I can't swing that for you right now,
I yelled back.
But it's in the pipeline. First you've got to do this. Earn some credit. Now let's get you out of sight before fucking Sandy Kim spots you.
Local law were keeping the press copters at bay. Ortega, still sick and shaking, wrapped herself in a police greatcoat and kept the local law out with the same glitter-eyed intensity that kept her upright and conscious. Organic Damage Division, shouting, pulling rank, bullying, and bluffing, held the fort while Elliot went to work faking in the monitor footage they needed. They were indeed, as Trepp had recognized, the biggest gang on the block.
I'm checking out of the apartment tomorrow, Elliot told me as she worked. You won't be able to reach me there.
She was silent for a couple of moments, whistling through her teeth at odd moments as she keyed in the images she had constructed. Then she cast a glance at me over her shoulder.
You say I'm earning juice from these guys doing this. They're going to owe me?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Then I'll contact them. Get me the officer in charge. I'll talk to whoever that is. And don't try to call me at Ember. I won't be there either.
I said nothing, just looked at her. She turned back to her work.
I need some time alone,
she muttered. Just the word sounded like a luxury to me. Chapter 38. I watched him pour a drink from the bottle of 15-year-old malt, take it to the phone, and seat himself carefully. The broken ribs had been welded back together in one of the ambulances, but the whole of that side was still one huge ache with occasional flinty stabs of agony. He sipped at the whiskey, gathered himself visibly, and punched out the call.
Bancroft residence, with whom do you wish to speak?
It was the severely suited woman who had answered last time I called Suntouch House. The same suit, the same hair, even the same makeup. Maybe she was a phone construct. Miriam Bancroft, he said. Once again, it was the sensation of being a passive observer, the same sensation of disconnection that I had felt that night in front of the mirror while Riker's sleeve put on its weapons. The frags. Only this time it was much worse.
One moment, please.
The woman disappeared from the screen and was replaced by the image of a wind-blown match flame in sync with piano music that sounded like autumn leaves being blown along a cracked and worn pavement. A minute passed, then Miriam Bancroft appeared, immaculately attired in a formal-looking jacket and blouse. She raised one perfectly groomed eyebrow.
Mr. Kovach, this is a surprise.
Yeah, well, he gestured uncomfortably. Even across the comlink, Miriam Bancroft radiated a sensuality that unbalanced him. Is this a secure line?
Reasonably so, yes. What do you want?
He cleared his throat. I've been thinking. There are some things I'd like to discuss with you. I may owe you an apology.
Indeed.
This time it was both eyebrows.
When exactly did you have in mind?
He shrugged. I'm not doing anything right now.
Yes. I, however, am doing something right now, Mr. Kovach. I am en route to a meeting in Chicago, and will not be back on the coast until tomorrow evening.
The faintest hint of a smile twitched at the corners of her mouth.
Will you wait?
Sure. She leaned toward the screen, eyes narrowing.
What happened to your face?
He raised a hand to one of the emerging facial bruises. In the low light of the room, he had not expected it to be so noticeable, nor had he expected Miriam Bancroft to be so attentive. Long story. I'll tell you when I see you.
Well, that I can hardly resist,
she said ironically.
I shall send a limousine to collect you from the Hendricks tomorrow afternoon. Shall we say about 4 o'clock? Good. Until then.
The screen cleared. He sat, staring at it for a moment, then switched off the phone and swiveled the chair around to face the window shelf. She makes me nervous, he said. Yeah, me too. Well, obviously. Very funny. I try. I got up to fetch the whiskey bottle. As I crossed the room, I caught my reflection in the mirror beside the bed. Where Riker's sleeve had the air of a man who had battered his way headfirst through life's trials, the man in the mirror looked as if he would be able to slip neatly aside at every crisis and watch fate fall clumsily on its fat face. The body was cat-like in its movements, a smooth and effortless economy of motion that would have looked good on Ancona Salamau. The thick, almost blue-black hair fell in a soft cascade to the deceptively slim shoulders, and the elegantly tilted eyes had a gentle, unconcerned expression that suggested the universe was a good place to live in. I had been in the Tech Ninja sleeve only a few hours. 7, and 42 minutes according to the time display chipped into my upper left field of vision, but there were none of the usual download sound effects.
I collected the whiskey bottle with one of the slim brown artist's hands, and the simple play of muscle and bone was a joy that glowed through me. The Kumalo Nurikem system thrummed continually at the limit of perception, as if it were singing faintly the myriad possible things the body could do at any given moment. Never, even during my time with the Envoy Corps, had I worn anything like it. I remembered Carnage's words and mentally shook my head. If the UN thought they'd be able to impose a 10-year colonial embargo on this, they were living in another world. "I don't know about you," he said, "but this feels fucking weird." "Tell me about it." I filled my own tumbler and proffered the bottle. He shook his head. I went back to the window shelf and sat back against the glass. How the fuck did Cadman stand it? Ortega says he used to work with himself all the time. Get used to anything in time, I suppose. Besides, Cadman was fucking crazy. Oh, and we're not? I shrugged. We didn't have a choice. Apart from walking away, I mean. Would that have been better? You tell me. You're the one who's going up against Kawahara. I'm just the whore around here. Incidentally, I don't reckon Ortega's exactly overjoyed about that part of the deal. I mean, she was confused before, but now... She's confused. How do you think I feel? I know how you feel, idiot. I am you. Are you? I sipped at my drink and gestured with the glass. How long do you think it takes before we stop being exactly the same person? He shrugged. You are what you remember. Right now we have only about 7 or 8 hours of separate perceptions. Can't have made much of a dent yet, can it? On 40-odd years of memory? I suppose not. And it's the early stuff that builds personality. Yeah, they say. And while we're on the subject, tell me something. How do you feel? I mean, how do we feel about the patchwork man being dead? I shifted uncomfortably. Do we need to talk about this? We need to talk about something. We're stuck here with each other until tomorrow evening. You can go out if you want. Come to that. I jerked a thumb upward toward the roof. I can get out of here the way I came in. You really don't want to talk about it that badly, huh? Wasn't that tough? That, at least, was true. The original draft of the plan had called for the ninja copy of me to stay at Ortega's apartment until the Riker copy had disappeared with Miriam Bancroft. Then it occurred to me that we'd need a working relationship with the Hendrix to bring off the assault on Head in the Clouds, and that there was no way for the ninja copy of myself to prove its identity to the hotel, short of submission to a storage scan. It seemed a better idea for the Riker copy to introduce the ninja before departing with Miriam Bancroft. Since the Riker copy was undoubtedly still under surveillance, at the very least, by Trapp, walking in through the front door of the Hendrix together looked like a very bad idea. I borrowed a grav harness and a stealth suit from Bautista, and just before it started to get light, I skimmed in between the patchy high-level traffic and down onto a sheltered flange on the 42nd floor. The Hendrix had by this time been advised of my arrival by the Riker copy and let me in through a ventilation duct. With the Kumalo Nurikem, it had been almost as easy as walking in through the front door. "Look," the Riker copy said, "I'm you. I know everything you know. What's the harm in talking about this stuff? If you know everything I know, what's the point of talking about it? Sometimes it helps to externalize things. Even if you talk to someone else about it, you're usually talking to yourself. The other guy's just providing a sounding board. You talk it out." I sighed. "I don't know. I buried all that shit about Dad a long time ago. It's a long time dead." "Yeah, right. I'm serious." "No." He flicked a finger at me the way I had pointed at Bancroft when he didn't want to face my facts on the balcony of Suntouch House. "You're lying to yourself. Remember that pimp we met in Laszlo's pipe house the year we joined Shenagan's 11? The one we nearly killed before they pulled us off him? That was just chemicals. We were off our head on Tetramath, showing off because of the 11 stuff. Fuck, we were only 16. "Bullshit. We did it because he looked like Dad." "Maybe." "Fact. And we spent the next decade and a half killing authority figures for the same reason." "Oh, give me a fucking break. We spent that decade and a half killing anyone who got in the way. It was the military. That's what we did for a living." And anyway, since when is a pimp an authority figure? Okay, maybe it was pimps we spent 15 years killing. Users. Maybe that's what we were paying back. He never pimped Mom out. Are you sure? Why were we so hot to hit the Elizabeth Elliot angle like a fucking tactical nuke? Why the accent on whorehouses in this investigation? Because, I said, sinking a finger of whiskey, that is what this investigation has been about from the beginning. We went after the Elliot angle because it felt right. Envoy intuition. The way Bancroft treated his wife. Oh, Miriam Bancroft. Now there's another whole disc we could spin. Shut up. Elliot was a pretty fucking good sounding shot. We wouldn't have got to head in the clouds without that trip to Jerry's biocabins.
Ah.
He made a disgusted gesture and tipped his own glass back. You believe what you want. I say the patchwork man's been a metaphor for Dad because we couldn't bear to look too closely at the truth. And that's why we freaked the first time we saw a composite construct in virtual. Remember that, do you? That wreck house on Adoracion? We had rage dreams for a week after that little show. Waking up with shreds of pillow on your hands. They sent us to the psychs for that. I gestured irritably. Yeah, I remember. I remember being shit scared of the patchwork man, not Dad. I remember feeling the same when we met Cadman in virtual, too. And now he's dead. How do we feel now? I don't feel anything. He pointed at me again. That's a cover. It is not a cover. The motherfucker got in my way. He threatened me, and now he's dead. Transmission ends. Remember anyone else threatening you, do you? When you were small, maybe? I'm not going to talk about this anymore. I reached for the bottle and filled my glass again. Pick another subject. What about Ortega? What are our feelings on that score? Are you planning to drink that whole bottle? You want some? No. I spread my hands. So what's it to you? Are you trying to get drunk? Of course I am. If I've got to talk to myself, I don't see why I should do it sober. So tell me about Ortega. I don't want to talk about that. Why not? I asked reasonably. Got to talk about something, remember? What's wrong with Ortega? What's wrong is that we don't feel the same about her. You aren't wearing Riker's sleeve anymore. That doesn't... Yes, it does. What's between us and Ortega is completely physical. There hasn't been time for anything else. That's why you're so happy to talk about her now. In that sleeve, all you've got is some vague nostalgia about that yacht and a bundle of snapshot memories to back it up. There's nothing chemical happening to you anymore. I reached for something to say and abruptly found nothing. We sat in silence, studying the amber depths of our glasses. The suddenly discovered difference sat between us like a third, unwanted occupant of the room. The Riker copy dug into his pockets and came up with Ortega's cigarettes. The pack was crushed almost flat. He extracted a cigarette, looked ruefully at it, and fitted it into his mouth. I tried not to look disapproving. Last one, he said, touching the ignition patch to it. The hotel probably has more. Yeah. He plumed out smoke, and I found myself almost envying him the addiction. You know, there is one thing we should be discussing right now. What's that? But I knew already. We both knew. You want me to spell it out? All right. He drew on the cigarette again and shrugged, not easily. We have to decide which of us gets obliterated when this is all over. And since our individual instinct for survival is getting stronger by the minute, we need to decide soon. How? I don't know. Which would you prefer to remember? Taking down Kawahara? Or going down on Miriam Bancroft? He smiled sourly. No competition, I suppose. Hey. This isn't just a role on the beach you're talking about. This is multiple copy sex. It's about the only genuinely illicit pleasure left. Anyway, Irene Elliott said we could do a memory graft and keep both sets of experience. Probably. She said we could probably do a memory graft, and that still leaves one of us to be canceled out. It's not a meld, it's a graft, from one of us to the other. Editing. You want to do that to yourself? To the one that survives? We couldn't even face editing that construct the Hendrix built. How are we going to live with this? No way, it's got to be a clean cut. One or the other.
and we've got to decide which.
Yeah. I picked up the whiskey bottle and stared gloomily at the label.
So what do? Gamble for it? Paper, scissors, stone, say the best of five? I was thinking along slightly more rational lines. We tell each other our memories from this point on, and then decide which we want to keep. Which ones are worth more.
How the hell are we going to measure something like that?
We'll know. You know we will.
What if one of us lies? Embroiders the truth to make it sound like a more appealing memory? Or lies about which one they like better?
His eyes narrowed. Are you serious?
A lot can happen in a few days. Like you said, we're both going to want to survive.
Ortega can polygraph us if it comes to that.
I think I'd rather gamble.
Give me that fucking bottle. If you're not going to take this seriously, neither am I. Fuck it, you might even get torched out there and solve the problem for us.
Thanks.
I passed him the bottle and watched as he decanted two careful fingers. Jimmy DeSoto had always said it was sacrilege to sink more than five fingers of single malt on any one occasion. After that, he maintained, you might as well be drinking blended. I had a feeling that we were going to profane that particular article of faith tonight. I raised my glass.
To unity of purpose.
Yeah, and an end to drinking alone. The hangover was still with me nearly a full day later as I watched him leave on one of the hotel monitors. He stepped out onto the pavement and waited while the long, polished limousine settled to the curb. As the curbside door hinged up, I caught a brief glimpse of Miriam Bancroft's profile within. Then he was climbing in, and the door swung smoothly back down to cover them both. The limousine trembled along its length and lifted away. I dry-swallowed more painkillers, gave it 10 minutes, and then went up to the roof to wait for Ortega. It was cold.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.